morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones. No relation, by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Stephen O'Donnell, author of the new story collection, Half Light. Stephen's a Portland-based artist whose work is widely collected both here in the U.S. and abroad. He's best known for his self-portraiture, working mainly in the genre known as historicized portrait, in which a recognizable subject is portrayed in period costume or mythological guise, a style Stephen has adopted from great artists of the 18th and 19th century. And he often plays on gender ambiguity with a healthy dose of tongue-in-cheek humor. Stephen previously published the book The Untold Gaze, a collection of his paintings paired with short fiction and poetry by 33 authors, all inspired by those paintings. He co-edited that book with his wife, writer, and graphic designer Gigi Little. The new story collection, Half Light, is Stephen's first work of fiction, and it's a violation of the laws of talent that he's so good at both the visual and written arts. Please join us for our conversation with Stephen, which is already in progress. Well, Stephen, thanks for joining us in the KBOO studios today.
Glad to be here.
Now, we did an interview back in 2018 for your book, The Untold Gaze, which was a collection of your artwork paired with short fiction by an amazing group of authors, 33 in all. In that interview, you said that you paint stories, which I found interesting. What do you mean by painting stories as opposed to writing them?
Well, there's always something going on. There, you know, the title of that book, The Untold Gaze, is kind of, you know, right there. It tells you that there is something going on there, but I don't explain it to you. You know, this is a pageant or some sort of picture of an event or a moment, and something's happening, but it isn't quite clear.
And that's what the viewer kind of fills in.
Exactly. And that's what sort of this prompt for these wonderful writers to find what they saw there and make something of it.
Yeah. In fact, this is a question that just came up yesterday when I was looking through your blog. And you had, I think it was the blog or maybe it was Facebook. Anyway, you recently posted the first email that you wrote to your now wife, Gigi Little, who at that time had written you a fan letter. She had seen some of your work at a showing, an exhibition.
20 years ago.
20 years ago, right. Yeah. So 2003. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, December 2003.
That's right.
And you wrote, quote, "I do my little paintings all alone at home." And then bang, they're out there for everyone to see and interpret for themselves. Right. They're so specific to me and my life experience, but it gives me such pleasure to have people find other stories there. Now, when you read the short fiction submitted for The Untold Gaze, each inspired by one of your paintings, were you surprised by some of the reactions to your work?
Totally. I mean, they were things I never would have thought of. Never would have thought of at all. It was wonderful. Yeah, it was a wonderful thing, wonderfully surprising. And yeah, we were just thrilled with every story that came in. It's like, what?
Such great writers.
Where'd that come from? You know, so, yeah.
Now, what was your takeaway from reading the stories other than your surprise? Maybe lessons learned about the effect of your visual art on the people viewing it?
Well, I mean, it sort of leads back to the very first art show I had where some instinct of mine told me to just go ahead and make work that was all about my life very specifically. And I dealt with childhood issues as very dramatized and dramatic. But I overheard a viewer, and this is back in 1995.
Your first one, yeah.
My very first art show. Before I'd never done anything before. But I heard a viewer say to a friend, looking at one of my images from my childhood, very dramatized, "Oh, wow, that's me. That's my life."
Ah.
And it was like, oh. It was a profound, it was, you know, the word profound is problematic, but it was a profound moment for me that for me to do what I did instinctually, whatever the word is.
Naturally.
There you go. To go to my exact, specific truth, which in turn produces something that is universal. That concept was huge to me.
I've read that a lot of artists have discovered the same. The more specific they are, the more personal, the more universal
yes,
it seems to be.
And I've never heard that concept before, and I experienced it boom right then. And so that's sort of been a guiding rule in whatever I make.
Now, in the afterword to the new book, Half-Light, you write that you've been making stories your entire adult life. You were a prodigy from the start, gifted not as a visual artist. And I remember in our interview before, you were saying that in grade school, even in the art classes, were just head and shoulders
above
everybody
else. I was the art boy. Yeah, that was my identity.
And you, and as we mentioned, you started showing professionally in 1995, so almost 30 years ago. But when did you start putting down those stories on the page, start writing them?
Well, I've wrote fragmentary things before. Nothing I took very seriously because I didn't feel like there was a place for it. And I also have always done lots of other things, music and design and various other things. And it's always been hard to focus on one or the other at a time. And then, you know, when I started showing art, that became the thing. And so everything else had to fit around that. So I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, I got serious about writing things down and keeping them and finishing them, or finishing them and then keeping them. And then one got published online. Someone heard it and said, oh, this is good. And, you know, we'd like to. And it's like, oh, okay. it was a big surprise to me. And that was a boost of confidence. A lot of it has to do with confidence.
Was that Nailed magazine?
Nailed, yes. Okay. Yeah.
And one of those, that story's actually in here.
It is,
From the streetcar.
From the streetcar, yes. And then another sort of moment, and it sort of ties in with the Untold Gaze book, is all these stories came in, and we had given the authors very specific instructions. You know, it can only be like 600 words long at the most, you know. So it's like very tight parameters we gave them. It just kind of, I guess I have a bit of competitiveness in me, and it's sort of like, you know, I've been around all these writers. I knew all these writers, and I feel
like— You're married to one.
I'm married to one, yes, exactly. And these stories came in, and there's a part of me that said, well, I could probably do this. And so I wrote a story influenced by one of my paintings, and I didn't have, I didn't limit myself to 600 words. And I enjoyed that, and so they just, these little stories just kept piling up over a period of 10 years or so. And I didn't really think about doing anything with them, but I kept going over them and thinking, well, you know, I kind of like that. Maybe it's good. I don't know. You know, nobody was seeing them. Well, actually, a couple times I was asked to do a reading at various things. I'm not even sure why they asked me, but you know, I got serious and wrote serious pieces and read them, and they went over well. And so,
and you were not taking any classes. You were not in any workshop. But you mentioned in the afterword, that same afterword in Half-Life, that you learned through osmosis a lot by sitting in on Gigi's sessions. So her workshops, like with Tom Spanbauer's Dangerous Writers, and I think it was Dami Shoemaker's Burnt Tongue that you sat in. And I think that was your debut as a reading. Burnt Tongue or some other?
I don't think I ever read it, Burnt Tongue. I hosted it as a, you know, a friendly thing, as a gesture, but I don't think I ever read anything I wrote necessarily. But it was just soaking that in. That's the way I learned how to paint also. Just looking at books, looking at, you know, art, just soaking in, not getting any instruction, but just learn. That's the way I learn best, is just to sit in it, you know, sort of like dive into the pool and swim around and just soak all of that stuff in. And I feel like that's how, you know, if I have any skill as a writer, it's like hearing writers talk about their work, hearing writers read their work, just being around them. I haven't taken any classes. I haven't been in a writing group. That idea of that terrifies me.
The word must have gotten out. You know, the dedication to Half-Light reads to those who kept telling me I was a writer when I said I wasn't.
Yeah.
And that's probably beyond Gigi. That's probably more of your friends in the Portland literary community. Yeah. You must have seen your work and said, Stephen, this is pretty good.
Yeah, yeah, little by little. And it's sort of a, you know, accelerated. There was little at the beginning, and then I would sort of sneak stuff out. And, you know, and then, you know, it just kind of built until it was like, well, you know, I'm not going to, I don't have the energy or the nerve to send my work out to publishers or agents or anything like that. But the technology now is such that, you know, we can print a nice looking little book. You know, if you have the money to do it, why not?
And actually, a lot of books are done that way now with kind of a lot of problems with the big commercial publishers who want somebody with a huge platform. Maybe they're not a writer, but they're a celebrity.
And so it's like, well, I had 10 stories. Why not just make a book, see what people say? And then the scary part came. People actually reading it.
To get to some of the differences between your art, your visual art and your written work.
Right.
The stories you write, I was wondering, what can you do on the page that you can't do on canvas with the stories you paint?
Well, I can finish the story. I can broaden the story. I've said before that, you know, if I could do my life over again and I had a totally different personality, I would have been a filmmaker, because that's kind of all-encompassing thing. You know, it's visual, it's textual, you know, music, all of those things. You know, that's what I would have done. And so, you know, there is a limitation to my paintings, these two-dimensional objects. They can only sort of ask, you know, subtly ask a question, but they can't go much further than that. I just leave everything up to the viewer to fill in if they choose.
Well, it's also, you're able to get a lot of your paintings are self-portraits, and the viewer who's looking at the painting can see you, and I wonder what he's thinking there. Seems got that smile on his face, little smirk,
right.
And but in the stories, you're very adept at interior thoughts. So we get to know beyond the dialogue, which is what everybody hears in the story. We get to know what characters are thinking, which is very important, and that's something that's much harder to convey, I think, in a visual art.
Well, yeah. Definitely. Unless you're making a film.
Static visual art, like a painting.
Right.
Now, another difference between fiction and painting, and I thought of this while reading the stories, your writing's very sensual, not just limited to the visual as with a painting. You get sight in, of course, through your descriptions, but also sounds, smells, tastes, and touch. Was that a challenge, though maybe a welcome one for you, something that you didn't have to consider for your visual work?
No, it wasn't really a challenge.
Maybe more of an opportunity then.
Opportunity, definitely. You know, it's always feels disappointing that I don't have more of a, just a fascinating explanation for why I paint what I paint, or why I paint, or what I, you know, write what I write, because so much is subconscious. You know, there's always something that sparks the thing, and then it's like the wheels start turning, and I don't really know where they're going necessarily, but because a lot of it seems to be put together already. The same with my painting. You know, I have an original idea for painting, and the finished painting is pretty much just that original idea finished. And the stories sort of come the same way, where it's bing.
is that spark the same? Like with a painting, you might be looking at, say, a painting from the 18th, 19th century, a portrait, saying, I think I could put myself in there. And then maybe a story, what the spark would that would be? Would a character or an image?
Well, the paintings don't come to me quite like that. They come more a concept for a visual. And then I will come up with the details and the setting and stuff. It's more of a compositional idea and a, I don't want to say gimmick, but you know, the story that I'm telling, like there's a painting of me several years back, 18th century, where I was a man having my hair done, and you know, there's a comb left in my hair, and you know, and someone's walked off and left me with half my hair done. you know, so that idea of that joke or whatever you'd call it sort of came to me. And then coming up with, okay, well, what do I need? I need, you know, like a drapery over me. I need, you know, what does a comb look like from...
Right, to show you were getting your hair done.
Yeah, to do the research and all that stuff. What does a chair railing look like that you can see? All that kind of stuff. And so sort of the same, you know, the same thing happens with the writing, oddly enough, where, you know, I'll have some idea, okay, for... I'm trying to think of an example here.
Did you want something from the book? Like,
yeah, I'm trying to think of an example
from a streetcar, how that started.
Well, that just came from me riding the you know, a winter streetcar, and it smelled bad, and you know, and I'm looking around, and you know, maybe I saw someone, you know, wearing fatigue pants or whatever, or something,
or with
holding
a skateboard.
Yeah, just something. It wasn't. A big deal. It wasn't a big thing.
And then off from there.
But once I was in that moment, you know, I thought, oh, this could be something. Once I was in that moment, all of the other stuff just sort of piled in. You know, it's like, okay, well, I'm getting off the streetcar. What does it feel like to walk on the sidewalk? You know, there are leaves, you know, stuck in the sidewalk after a rainy autumn day. And you
those
know,
were all the sensual touches.
Yeah, what does the sound like, you know? Uh-huh. But it just kind of, I mean, it just is there. It's in my head.
So from that image, yeah, that scene, the story proceeds.
Right. And also this weird thing that seems to happen in almost everything I write, where I know the beginning, and the beginning kind of writes itself. I'm just boom, 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 boom. And I know the ending. And then,
oh, you usually know the ending.
I know how it lands. And then, you know, those things show up pretty much at the same time. And then, you know, I have to fill in the in-between part. So I don't know why it's that way, but, you know, it's actually kind of helpful. So, yeah.
Now, we talked about the sensuality of the writing as opposed to the painting, which is more sight. But still, sight seems primary in your work. And we could start with the book's title, Half Light.
Mm. Mm.
The term basically means a light that's partly dimmed or obscured, a low light in which you can't see things very clearly, like at dawn or dusk. And when we did the interview for The Untold Gaze, we also talked about that title and its multiple meanings, untold and gaze both, which you said is something both you and Gigi love.
Right.
The multiplicity of that, not ambiguity so much, but the multiple meanings.
Right.
Why did you choose Half Light for this book's title?
I don't remember exactly how we got to it, but...
It's very evocative.
Well, thank you. I think it has to do with... You know, we have all these stories which are kind of dark. I mean, there's a lot of darkness in there. I mean, it's, you know, something that certainly I talk about in the afterword, where my paintings are often bright and colorful.
And humorous at times.
And humorous, yeah. And
there's birds in there and monkeys.
Oh, yeah.
And Nicholas, your dog.
Yeah, all sorts of... You know, and that's part of what I want to bring, sort of this delight, you know, in my work. And the stories come from a different place. I don't know how much I can explain why there is that difference. It just is. And so, you know, the question about whether they're depressing or not, you know, this is kind of out there. But that's just how. You know, I like sad movies. You know, I like ambiguity.
Sometimes depressing things can cheer us up.
Well,
I mean, the whole basis of the blues is that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Music.
Well, the link between, you know, sadness and beauty, you know, is a big thing for me in the art that I like, in the film I like, music I like. You know, oh, it's gloriously, beautifully sad. So I think that is something that is, you know... coming out in my stories. And so, you know, what were you going to call the book? The most depressing book you've ever read. You know,
it's well, that interested me in the title. What came to my mind was something similar to the old question, is the glass half empty or half full?
Right.
In this case, some of your characters can see the light in that half light, however dim, and some can only see the darkness.
Right, yeah.
The other half of that half light.
Right. Yeah, and... Yeah. I don't know what more to say about that, but yeah.
Well, I'll talk more about light, because I noticed this this very painterly use of light in the stories. I can give three examples. In Drop, one of the stories you write, all he could see was the sunlight coming through the branches of the tree above him, a very strong image. In From the Streetcar, which we talked about, I can take in how the dim light shining down catches the blonde ends of his lashes. That's the skateboarder. And in Two Brothers, quote, that moment not long before the sun climbs up from the back of the hill, a few scarce seconds when the soft light through the branches seems to flicker slightly, to vibrate. Again, very evocative, a very strong image. That focus on light seems to follow you from one medium to the other. Maybe something you didn't notice yourself, but as a reader, I just I started underlining every time you mentioned the word light and showed some lighting, whether it was indoor lighting, interior lighting, or outdoors, the sun.
Yeah. You know, nobody can see me blushing right now, or hearing you read my words to me is like, almost made me cry.
It's so beautiful.
And, thank you.
And when you first sat down and we started talking before I started recording, I mentioned, and I hope it doesn't sound like a knock, how surprising it was to, at how advanced you were as a writer. This is your first book of fiction.
And
it's not even your primary art, which is more visual. But maybe they should be at the same the same level. They're both primary.
Oh, man. just, you know.
Okay.
I'm like, what do I say? I don't know.
You
know.
More about the book.
Okay.
There are 10 stories across a whole range of time periods and settings with characters of different gender, sexual orientation, varying in age, from the young to the old, sometimes the same character in the same piece. As with the stories, the leaves at the top and in spring and in winter, from young to old. And another, in one case, it was young to old, back to young again, another flashback.
Right.
And there's even one ghost story.
That surprised me, yes.
So I guess that answers my question. I was going to ask, was that a conscious decision to kind of mix things up with these different characters and situations and settings?
Not really. No, it's just like, what was I inspired by? You know, what did I want to write? The conscious part of it came in arranging the stories in the collection. And that was hard. And I think maybe the only time that was a consideration was writing the last story. Because
Miss Marine.
That wasn't the last one written.
Oh, okay.
That was not the last one written.
It was the last one in the book.
Yeah. Okay. It came into consideration when I had 10. I wanted to do 10. 10 must be it. I have to do 10.
Nice round.
Yeah. And I had one piece that isn't in here that was sort of a prose poem or something. And it was actually a poem that I was trying to make into something else. And I wasn't happy with it. And so as a whim, as a kind of a joke, I asked Gigi, you know, give me a subject for a story. Maybe I'll just write another one, you know. Which is not how I write. Usually it's sort of like when something comes to me, I will write it. And you know,
I don't take prompts from Gigi.
No, and I don't force myself to sit down and write ever. You know, it's just like, oh, well, the muse is with me, I will write something. But it's like, I want something else that, you know, just give me a prompt. And she gave me a prompt and I wrote a story.
Do you remember the prompt?
Yes. Well, it's the ceiling with two... Painted Birds. I can't remember the title of my own story, but I think that's the title of the story. And she said, a guy is hiding out in a pool house.
Ah, yes, I know the story now.
Yeah. And I'm like, okay, fine. And then...
And it happens to be a girl in the story, a runaway.
Well, yeah, what had happened is it was, you know, that was the prompt she gave me. So I made it a guy first, and he was a drug addict, and he was a hustler. And I'm like, I don't want to spend time with this. You know, I didn't feel expert enough on the subject to, you know, talk about drug addiction and serious things like that. So it's like, okay, so, and I didn't want to write a guy or something. Anyways, it morphed into something else. But the ending was always pretty much the same. So anyways, what was the question?
Well, that actually leads me into another question I wanted to ask.
Okay.
And that's, despite the differences between the stories, there are a few constant themes. And the one that stands out most for me is one of connection, usually between two very different characters. So in that story with the girl in the pool house, she meets an older woman who's lives in the big house. And the pool house belongs to her, her estate. And they have that connection, even though they're from very different backgrounds. Some of the characters have a sense of desperation, a desire for escape. And that connection can be fleeting, as in from the streetcar, which is between the skateboarder and the guy on the streetcar. And they meet up later. Or more permanent, as in Spring in Winter, which is a, just a beginning and an end. There's not much in between. But it that one of connection, I think you mentioned it in... either your blog post or in the afterword, that it is an important theme for you and perhaps maybe easier to explore in fiction than paintings. Because paintings is usually just one character, and it could be you in a self-portrait. But here you've got at least two characters, and they connect in some way despite their differences and the way they met in the beginning.
Yeah, it's a totally different thing. I mean, I don't even think about that as a... Again, you know, I feel disappointing as a person talking about my work because I can't explain it enough. You know, it just is. You know, I'm a surprise by anybody else. That, you know, it's like, oh yeah, they are about connection. That's very interesting. Why do I do that?
It'd be pretty boring to write and know everything in advance.
But I mean, it does make me enjoy my work. You know, that it's like I read it over and go.
It's more an act of discovery than just getting things down. Paper that you already know. Now, another theme, and this was also in that A Ceiling with Painted Bird, the pool house story, is one of a troubled adolescent or teen, usually someone running away from an abusive situation, as the girl in the story
was. True. Didn't even think about that till now.
Because they're not like everyone else. In fact, you even have a story based on this theme called Exiles, which I thought, hey, that would have made a good title for the collection, too, though I think it's been used. And Stephen, from when we talked before, I have to think some of this is autobiographical, based on your own adolescence and teen years. And when we talked before for Untold Gaze, I mentioned a painting you have called Tatouage, a young boy who looks very much like you at that age, with a buzz cut. He's framed from the chest up, wearing no clothes, and he's tattooed on the flesh. And we're seeing it as if in a mirror, because the tattoos are, we have to read them backwards, mirror image. And the words are words like fat, snob, mean, sissy, ugly, shy, baby, useless, lazy. I was thinking that boy could probably be a character in one of these stories. And maybe he's the
Are you giving me a prompt now?
Yes.
I see another story coming
up. We're on you now.
Oh, no.
No, I saw that, and I can even see that in the girl here. She's getting away. She wants some kind of refuge. And then that connection makes a world of difference for her.
Well, I mean, you know, especially if I'm working out of my subconscious, you know, so much of this has to be me, you know, definitely the characters, the story Drop is dealing with aging and hopelessness and you know, it's...
And that's a very dark one.
But it's definitely, you know, something that, you know, I know where that came from, you know, my own feelings of aging and you know,
and
my
knee
hurts.
And I think that's universal.
And,
yes.
You know, and you know.
Especially given our last few years.
Yeah. And just, you know,
One of my favorite stories in the book is Miss Marine. And that's the last story in the book. Well, first I should ask, because this is the first I found out, that why didn't you put the last story you wrote as the last story in the book? In other words, why'd you pick Miss Marine for that kind of ending there? In other words, they were not sequenced in chronological
order.
Not
at all. Well, a lot of it was just, you know, I'm an arranger. All my work is arranged. If you came to our house, you know, everything has its place. You know, so it's like, okay, you know, we have stories that are guy stories. So we have two women stories. We have, you know, so
it was, two Depression era stories.
Yeah, and I didn't want things close to each other.
Some suicide stories.
Yeah, yeah. So it was, you know, to divide that up, to arrange it. And I also wanted to, without giving anything away, I wanted to end on at least a hopeful note.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about that, about this story in particular. Yeah. So it takes place in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. Which is a favorite time period for you. And we talked before about how you and I are both big TCM and old movie fans, especially those Depression era movies. And the title character, Maureen, is on her way to California, to Hollywood, where she wants to experience some of that movie magic for herself. And she dreams of being Greta Garbo, Kay Francis, Norma Shearer, Joan Crawford, you know, these glorious figures from that time. But on the way, she gets stuck in Cedarville, which I think is a fictional town.
It's in
New Mexico.
Yeah.
And not far from Albuquerque.
Right.
And against all odds, finds someone there who seems to see her and accept her for who she truly is. And I thought, after the darkness, including some of those suicides in the previous stories, this was just a very just helpful note to end on, and I appreciated that. I'm grateful for that.
Well, good. I'm glad you got it.
But I also thought it was a very strong story. It wasn't just, let's throw the reader a bone here.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm glad you saw it, because one reader didn't get that it did end happily. So I was like, oh.
Well, there's ways of looking at it.
Right.
You know?
It's a little
I won't go too much into it, because you have some prize there. But I think you could take it both ways.
Yeah.
But very lifelike, very real. You know what I was thinking of, and again, based on our love of TCM and old movies, after I read it, I couldn't help but think of the last line from Some Like It Hot, Joey Brown saying, well, nobody's perfect.
Yes, yes.
Did that come to mind to you at all?
No, but I mean, that's definitely a...
kind of acceptance on steroids.
Huh? Yes. And again, neither one of us want to give too much away about that story. But there is a part of that story is the letter written to Maureen by
the high school principal.
That I cannot, I wrote the damn thing, but I cannot read that letter without getting choked up or getting teary. There's something about that I find very moving. Just like I said, I wrote the thing, but it just that acceptance, that level of acceptance and respect that is in that letter.
I felt the same way, and I think most readers will share our feelings there. Reading the whole story,
and understanding, understanding without a hammer over the head. It's just like that. In a written way of just kind of looking at someone and saying, I get it.
And putting ourselves in Maureen's shoes and realizing how important that was for her.
Somebody
who was just running away from who she really was the whole story, her whole life.
I see you and that's okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, just a few last questions. Yeah. One was on the cover. Uh-huh. And this is a sketch you did for one of your paintings, Autumn into Winter. It's a black and white sketch. Mm-hmm. The finished piece is in color, and I'll have that on the episode page, the website. Why did you and Gigi pick this for the cover, and why the sketch rather than the finished painting? Is that another play on the title Half-Light? This is much dimmer than the actual painting itself.
Yeah. And this is even more than the photograph that I took of the work in progress is what it was.
It wasn't finished at that point.
No, it was, I draw out the design of the painting on a panel, and then there's a wash of yellow underpainting on it. And I had just happened to take a picture of it in that state, and I had that in a folder on my computer. We were looking for an image that would work, and most of them were just too bold, or you couldn't really put text over them, and so.
Oh yes, your paintings are very colorful. That would be difficult.
Yeah, and so we just found this, and we just toned it down, and my wife. Is this amazing graphic designer.
The best cover designer in the country.
Oh, my God. I mean, she's working all the time.
Prodigious.
All over the place. She works for, she's Forest Avenue Press's house designer for their covers, but she's also doing all these other publishers' works, and just, she's also an amazing editor. So it's like, how lucky did I get? I didn't have to leave the house,
You married up.
Yeah. Well, she edited the book and then, did my cover. She laid out the whole thing. And it's like, Okay.
Yeah. And she collaborated with you on The Untold Gaze, we should mention, too.
Oh, well, she
editing
did,
and
she
helping,
did all the work.
Helping solicit the
yeah.
text.
I mean, it was easy for me. I'd already done the paintings, you know. So she had to edit all the stories that came in and lay out the whole thing. And yeah.
Now, one last question, which I think brings us back to the very beginning of the interview. Now that Half-Light is out and your talent as a writer is exposed to the world, do you still feel as you write in the books afterward, quote, like an imposter, almost an intruder in this realm?
Totally.
You shouldn't.
No, the thing is, this has made me incredibly and surprisingly vulnerable. I feel very vulnerable about the thing. It's like, this whole interview, I could like barely talk about anything because I've been a visual artist all my life, since I was a small child. Almost 30 years I've been doing it professionally. I have accepted the praise and to learn how to take it gracefully. And I know how good I am and what my limitations are also. And, you know, it's what I do. And people have been very nice. And also the reaction to a painting is, it's now. You see something, boom. You know, you either like it or you don't, you know, and you move on. Maybe you think about it later, maybe you don't, depending on the work. This is very different. This is, you know.
You're spending more time with the stories
generally.
Well,
yeah. I give the book to somebody, you know, or they buy it or whatever, and then they go away, and I don't know what they're thinking. You know, I know that when I read people's books, sometimes it's like, well, I like it or I don't like it. And if I like it, maybe I'll say something. But so it's like, there's a lot of copies of this book out there. A lot of people I haven't heard nothing from. You know, I was like, do they hate it? You know?
Hey, that's the same thing with the radio. I have no idea who's listening or what they're thinking.
Yeah. But then I've gotten
I think that's every artist's dilemma, huh?
I guess, but somehow it's a very different experience for me. On the other hand, I've gotten some lovely things said to me that, again, I'm just like, you know, practically in tears because it's like, in a way, this is much more personal to me. I'm not sure why. Maybe it's just because it's new out in the world. It's not something I've been doing for a long time. And I'm just so much more confident of my artwork because I know it's good, or I know it's good enough for me. It pleases me. But this somehow, writing is somehow more...
intimate, would you say?
It is
revealing.
Intimate. It is more intimate, yeah. And also, it's hard for me to judge it in the same way. With painting, I have my own standards of what's good and what's not, you know, with what I do or what other people do. And so it's easy for me to judge whether I think it's good or not. And there's a broader range of taste and interest that people have about writing. Some people like this kind of book, some people like that, some people like poetry, some people hate this, you know. It's very different and I felt very, very vulnerable when people, I used to be bad about compliments about my work, about my artwork. And now it's like, yes, thank you. I can be very graceful about it. Now it's like people say, oh, I really like that writing. I'm like, oh, geez, you know, let me hide behind the door.
That story. Yeah.
Oh, no. I don't feel bad about it. I mean, I'm not going to put out anything in the world.
It's just harder
that
to take
I
the
feel
compliment.
Is bad. It's just hard for me to take the compliment. I feel embarrassed by it, and I feel awkward, and like I'm going to start crying or something.
I
ridiculous.
Think there's writers who've been doing this for over 30 years, like you've been doing your painting, who feel the same way. So.
Oh, okay. Well. Talk to me in 30 years.
I'd love that if we're still around.
Yeah.
Well, Stephen, thanks so much for talking with us today. I'll see you in 30 years.
Okay, very good.
About the new story collection and your painting, you're truly an artist in both realms.
Thank you very much.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KABU Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, would like to hear the longer, unexpurgated version, the director's cut, you might call it if we had a director, you can listen anytime on demand at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Stephen O'Donnell, author of the new story collection, Half Light. You can learn more about Stephen, all his work, both painting and prose, and purchase a copy of Half Light, if you like, online at StephenO'DonnellArtist.com. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, February 8th at 11 a.m. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying,
well, nobody's perfect.